But what always struck him in her as something unlooked for was the expression of her eyes, soft, serene, and truthful. And above all, her smile, which always transported Levin to an enchanted world, where he felt moved and tender as he remembered himself during certain rare days of his early childhood. "Have you been here long?" she said, giving him her hand. "Thank you," she added, as he picked up the handkerchief that had fallen out of her muff. "I? Not long ago. Yesterday. I mean, I arrived today," answered Levin in his emotion, not comprehending her question immediately. "I meant to come and see you," he said, and then recollecting what his intention was in seeking her, he was promptly overcome with confusion and blushed. "I didn't know you could skate and skate so well." She looked at him attentively, as though wishing to make out the cause of his confusion. "Your praise is worth having. The tradition is kept up here that you are the best of skaters," she said, with her little black gloved hand brushing some needles of hoarfrost off her muff. "Yes, I used to skate with passion once upon a time. I wanted to attain perfection." "You do everything with passion, I think," she said, smiling. "I should so like to see how you skate. Do put on skates and let's skate together." "Skate together? Can that be possible?" thought Levin, gazing at her. "I'll put them on directly," he said, and he went off to get skates. "It's a long while since we've seen you here, sir," said the attendant, supporting his foot and screwing on the heel of the skate. "Except you, there's none of the gentlemen first-rate skaters. Will that be all right?" said he, tightening the strap. "Oh, yes, yes, make haste, please," answered Levin, with difficulty restraining the smile of rapture which would overspread his face. "Yes," he thought, "this is life, this is happiness." "Together," she said, "let us skate together. Speak to her now." "But that's just why I'm afraid to speak, because I'm happy now, happy even though only in hope, and then? But I must, I must, I must." Away, faint-heartedness. Levin rose to his feet, took off his overcoat, and gaining speed over the rough ice round the pavilion, came out on the smooth ice and skated without effort, as it were, by simple exercise of will, increasing and slackening speed and turning his course. He approached her with timidity, but again her smile reassured him. She gave him her hand, and they set off side by side, going faster and faster, and the more rapidly they moved, the more tightly she grasped his hand. "With you, I should soon learn. I somehow feel confidence in you," she said to him. "And I have confidence in myself when you are leaning on me," he said, but was at once frightened at what he had said and blushed. And indeed, no sooner had he uttered these words than all at once, like the sun going behind a cloud, her face lost all its tenderness, and Levin detected the familiar change in her expression that denoted mental concentration. A tiny wrinkle came upon her smooth brow. "Is there anything troubling you? However, I've no right to ask such a question," he said hurriedly. "Oh, why so?" "No, I have nothing to trouble me," she responded coldly, and immediately added, "You haven't seen Mademoiselle Linon, have you?" "Not yet." "Go and speak to her. She likes you so much." "What's wrong? Have I offended her? Lord help me," thought Levin, and he flew towards the old Frenchwoman with the gray ringlets, who was sitting on a bench. Smiling and showing her false teeth, she greeted him as an old friend. "Yes, you see, we're growing up," she said to him, glancing toward Kitty, "and growing old." "Tiny Bear has grown big now," pursued the Frenchwoman, laughing, and she reminded him of his joke about the three young ladies whom he had compared to the three bears in the English nursery tale. "Do you remember that's what you used to call them?" He remembered absolutely nothing, but she had been laughing at the joke for 10 years now and was fond of it. "Now go and skate. Go and skate. Our Kitty has learned to skate nicely, hasn't she?" When Levin darted up to Kitty, her face was no longer stern. Her eyes looked at him with the same sincerity and tenderness, but Levin fancied that in her tenderness there was a certain note of deliberate composure, and he felt depressed. After talking a little of her old governess and her peculiarities, she questioned him about his life. "Surely you must feel dull in the country in the winter," she said. "No, I'm not dull. I am very busy," he said, feeling that she was making him submit to her composed tone, which he would not have the strength to break through, just as had been the case at the beginning of the winter. Are you going to stay in town long? Kitty questioned him. I don't know, he answered, not thinking of what he was saying. The thought came into his mind that if he were held in submission by her tone of quiet friendliness, he would end by going back again without deciding anything, and he resolved to mutiny against it. How is it you don't know? I don't know. It depends upon you, he said, and was immediately horror-stricken at his own words. Whether it was that she did not hear his words, or that she did not want to hear them, she made a sort of stumble, twice struck out, and hurriedly skated away from him. She skated up to Mademoiselle Linen, said something to her, and went toward the pavilion where the ladies took off their skates. My God, what have I done? Merciful God, help me, guide me, said Levin, praying inwardly and at the same time feeling a need of violent exercise. He skated about, describing concentric and eccentric circles. At that moment, one of the young men, the best of the skaters of the day, came out of the coffee house on his skates with a cigarette in his mouth. Taking a run, he dashed down the steps on his skates, crashing and leaping. He flew down and, without even changing the free and easy position of his hands, skated away over the ice. Ah, that's a new trick, said Levin, and he promptly ran up to the top to perform this new trick. Don't break your neck. This needs practice. Nikolai Shcherbatsky shouted after him. Levin went to the steps, took a run from above as best he could, and dashed down, preserving his balance in this unwonted movement with his hands. On the last step he stumbled, but barely touching the ice with his hand, with a violent effort recovered himself and skated off laughing. What a fine darling chap he is, Kitty was thinking at that moment as she came out of the pavilion with Mademoiselle Linen and looked toward him with a smile of quiet kindness, as though he were a favorite brother. And can it be my fault? Can I have done anything wrong? They talk of coquetry. I know it's not he that I love, but still I am happy with him, and he's so nice. Only why did he say that? She mused. Catching sight of Kitty going away and her mother meeting her at the steps, Levin flushed from his rapid exercise, stood still, and pondered a minute. He took off his skates and overtook the mother and daughter at the entrance of the gardens. Delighted to see you, said Princess Shcherbatskaya. On Thursdays we are at home, as always. Today, then? We shall be pleased to see you, the princess said stiffly. This stiffness hurt Kitty, and she could not resist the desire to smooth over her mother's coldness. She turned her head and with a smile said, Goodbye till this evening. At that moment, Stepan Arkadyevich, his hat cocked on one side with beaming face and eyes, strode into the garden like a buoyant conqueror. But as he approached his mother-in-law, he responded to her inquiries about Dolly's health with a mournful and guilty countenance. After a little subdued and dejected conversation with her, he set straight his chest again and took Levin by the arm. Well, shall we set off? He asked. I've been thinking about you all this time, and I'm very, very glad you've come, he said, looking him in the face with a significant air. Yes, come along, answered Levin in ecstasy, hearing unceasingly the sound of that voice saying, Goodbye till this evening, and seeing the smile with which it was said. To England or the Hermitage? It's all the same to me. Well, then, England it is, said Stepan Arkadyevich, selecting the restaurant because he owed more there than at the Hermitage, and consequently considered it mean to avoid it. Have you got a sleigh? That's fine, for I sent my carriage home. The friends hardly spoke all the way. Levin was wondering what that change in Kitty's expression had meant, and alternately assuring himself that there was hope, and falling into despair, seeing clearly that his hopes were insane, and yet all the while he felt himself quite another man, utterly unlike what he had been before her smile and those words, Goodbye till this evening. Stepan Arkadyevich was absorbed during the drive in composing the menu of the dinner. You like turbo, don't you? He said to Levin as they were arriving. Eh? Responded Levin. The turbo? Yes, I'm awfully fond of turbo. Chapter 10. When Levin went into the restaurant with Oblonsky, he could not help noticing a certain peculiarity of expression, as it were, a restrained radiance about the face and whole figure of Stepan Arkadyevich. Oblonsky took off his overcoat and, with his hat over one ear, walked into the dining room, giving directions to the Tatar waiters, who were clustered about him in evening coats and with napkins under their arms, bowing right and left to acquaintances who, here as everywhere, greeted him joyously. He went up to the bar, took a little wine glass of vodka and a snack of fish, and said to the painted Frenchwoman decked in ribbons, lace, and ringlets behind the desk, something so amusing that even that Frenchwoman was moved to genuine laughter. Levin, for his part, refrained from taking any vodka only because he found most offensive this Frenchwoman, all made up, it seemed, of false hair, poudre de riz, and vinaigre de toilette. He made haste to move away from her as from a dirty place. His whole soul was filled with memories of Kitty, and there was a smile of triumph and happiness shining in his eyes. "This way, Your Excellency, please." "Your Excellency won't be disturbed here," said a particularly pertinacious, white-headed old Tatar, with immense hips and coattails gaping widely behind. "Walk in, Your Excellency," he said to Levin, being attentive to his guest as well, by way of showing his respect to Stepan Arkadyevich. Instantly flinging a fresh cloth over the round table under the bronze sconce, though it already had a tablecloth on it, he pushed up velvet chairs and came to a standstill before Stepan Arkadyevich, with a napkin and a bill of fare in his hands, awaiting his commands. "If you prefer it, Your Excellency, a private room will be free directly. Prince Golitsyn with a lady. Fresh oysters have come in." "Ah, oysters," Stepan Arkadyevich became thoughtful. "How if we were to change our program, Levin?" he said, keeping his finger on the bill of fare, and his face expressed serious hesitation. "Are the oysters good? Mine now." "They're Flensburg, Your Excellency. We've no Ostend." "Flensburg will do, but are they fresh?" "Only arrived yesterday." "Well, then, how if we were to begin with oysters, and so change the whole program, eh?" "It's all the same to me. I should like cabbage soup and porridge better than anything, but of course there's nothing like that here." "Porridge a la Russe, Your Honor would like," said the Tatar, bending down to Levin, like a nurse speaking to a child. "No, joking apart, whatever you choose is sure to be good. I've been skating and I'm hungry. And don't imagine," he added, detecting a look of dissatisfaction on Oblonsky's face, "that I shan't appreciate your choice. I don't object to a good dinner." "I should hope so. After all, it's one of the pleasures of life," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "Well then, my friend, you give us 2, or better say 3 dozen oysters, clear soup with vegetables." "Printanier?" prompted the Tatar. But Stepan Arkadyevich apparently did not care to allow him the satisfaction of giving the French names of the dishes. "With vegetables in it, you know. Then turbot with thick sauce, then roast beef, and mind it's good. Yes, and capons, perhaps, and then stewed fruit." The Tatar, recollecting that it was Stepan Arkadyevich's way not to call the dishes by the names in the French bill of fare, did not repeat them after him, but could not resist rehearsing the whole menu to himself according to the bill. "Soup, grenadière, turbot, sauce, beaumarchais, poulard d'estragon, marsadon de fruits," and then instantly, as though worked by springs, laying down one bound bill of fare, he took up another, the list of wines, and submitted it to Stepan Arkadyevich. "What shall we drink?" "What you like, only not too much." "Champagne?" said Levin. "What, to start with?" "You're right, though, I dare say. Do you like the white seal?" "Cachet Blanc," prompted the Tatar. "Very well, then, give us that brand with the oysters, and then we'll see." "Yes, sir, and what table wine?" "You can give us Neuss. Oh, no, better the classic Chablis." "Yes, sir, and your cheese, Your Excellency?" "Ah, yes, Parmesan. Or would you like another?" "No, it's all the same to me," said Levin, unable to suppress a smile. And the Tatar ran off with flying coattails, and in 5 minutes darted in with a dish of opened oysters in their nacreous shells and a bottle between his fingers. Stepan Arkadyevich pressed the starchy napkin, tucked it into his waistcoat, and settling his arms comfortably, started on the oysters. "Not bad," he said, detaching the jellied oysters from their pearly shells with a small silver fork and swallowing them one after another. "Not bad," he repeated, turning his dewy, brilliant eyes now upon Levin, now upon the Tatar. Levin ate the oysters, too, though white bread and cheese pleased him better, but he was admiring Oblonsky. Even the Tatar, uncorking the bottle and pouring the sparkling wine into the delicate funnel-shaped glasses, and adjusting his white cravat, kept on glancing at Stepan Arkadyevich with a perceptible smile of satisfaction. "You don't care much for oysters, do you?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, emptying his wine glass. "Or are you worried about something, eh?" He wanted Levin to be in good spirits, but it was not that Levin was not in good spirits, he was ill at ease. With what he had in his soul, he felt hard and awkward in the restaurant, in the midst of private rooms where men were dining with ladies, in all this fuss and bustle, the surroundings of bronzes, looking glasses, gas, and potters. All of this was offensive to him. He was afraid of sullying what his soul was brimful of. Yes, I am worried, but besides that, all this bothers me," he said. "You can't conceive how queer it all seems to a countryman like me, as queer as that gentleman's nails I saw at your office." "Yes, I saw how much interested you were in poor Grinevich's nails," said Stepan Arkadyevich, laughing. "It's too much for me," responded Levin. "Do try now to put yourself in my place. Take the point of view of a countryman. We in the country try to bring our hands into such a state as will be most convenient for working with. So we cut our nails. Sometimes we tuck up our sleeves. And here people purposely let their nails grow as long as possible and wink on small saucers by way of studs so that they can do nothing with their hands." Stepan Arkadyevich smiled gaily. "Oh, yes, that's just a sign that he has no need to do coarse work. His work is with his mind. Maybe, but still it's queer to me. Just as at this moment it seems queer to me that we country folks try to satiate ourselves as soon as we can, so as to be ready for work, while here we are trying to delay satiety as long as possible, and with that object are eating oysters." "Why, of course," objected Stepan Arkadyevich, "but that's just the aim of culture, to make everything a source of enjoyment." "Well, if that's its aim, I'd rather be a savage." "You are a savage as it is. All you Levins are savages." Levin sighed. He remembered his brother Nikolai and felt ashamed and pained, and he scowled. But Oblonsky began speaking of a subject which at once drew his attention. "Oh, I say, are you going tonight to our people, the Shcherbatskys, I mean," he said, his eyes sparkling significantly as he pushed away the empty rough shells and drew the cheese toward him. "Yes, I shall certainly go," replied Levin, "though I fancy the princess was not very warm in her invitation." "What nonsense! That's her manner. Come, boy, the soup." "That's her manner, grand dame," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "I'm coming, too, but I have to go to the Countess Bolin's rehearsal. Come, isn't it true that you're a savage? How do you explain the sudden way in which you vanished from Moscow? The Shcherbatskys were continually asking me about you as though I ought to know. The only thing I know is that you always do what no one else does." "Yes," said Levin slowly and with emotion, "you're right. I am a savage. Only my savageness is not in having gone away, but in coming now. Now I have come." "Oh, what a lucky fellow you are," broke in Stepan Arkadyevich, looking into Levin's eyes. "Why?" "I can tell the gallant steeds by some, I don't know what, paces. I can tell youths by their faces," declaimed Stepan Arkadyevich. "Everything is before you." "Why, is it over for you already?" "No, not over exactly, but the future is yours and the present is mine. And the present, well, it's only fair to middling." "How so?" "Oh, things aren't right, but I don't want to talk of myself. Besides, I can't explain it all," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "Well, why have you come to Moscow, then?" "Hi, clear the table," he called to the Tatar. "Are you trying to surmise?" responded Levin, his eyes gleaming in their depth, fixed on Stepan Arkadyevich. "I am, but I can't be the first to talk about it. You can see by that whether I surmise right or wrong," said Stepan Arkadyevich, gazing at Levin with a subtle smile. "Well, and what have you to say to me?" said Levin in a quivering voice, feeling that all the muscles of his face were quivering too. "How do you look at it?" Stepan Arkadyevich slowly emptied his glass of Chablis, never taking his eyes off Levin. "I," said Stepan Arkadyevich, There's nothing I desire so much as that. Nothing. It would be the best thing that could happen. But you're not making a mistake. You know what we're speaking of, said Levin, piercing him with his eyes. You think it's possible?
I think it's possible. Why not?
No, do you really think it's possible?
No.
Tell me all you think.
Oh, but if refusal's in store for me,
indeed I feel sure.
What makes you think so? Said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling at his excitement.
It seems so to me sometimes. That will be awful for me, and for her too.
Oh, well, anyway, there's nothing awful in it for a girl. Every girl's proud of a proposal.
Yes, every girl, but not she.
Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled.
He so well knew that feeling of Levin's that for him all the girls in the world were divided into two classes. One class, all the girls in the world except her, and those girls with all sorts of human failings, and very ordinary girls. The other class, she alone, having no failings of any sort, and higher than all humanity.
Stay, take some sauce, he said, holding back Levin's hand, who was pushing the sauce away.
Levin obediently helped himself to sauce, but would not let Stepan Arkadyevitch go on with his dinner.
No, stop a minute, he said. You must understand that it's a question of life and death for me. I have never spoken to anyone of this, and there's no one to whom I could speak of it, except yourself. You know we're utterly unlike each other, different in tastes and views and everything, but I know you're fond of me and understand me, and that's why I like you awfully. But for God's sake, be quite straightforward with me.
I tell you what I think, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling, but I'll say more. My wife is a wonderful woman.
Stepan Arkadyevitch sighed, recalling his relations with his wife, and after a moment's silence resumed. She has a gift of foreseeing things. She sees right through people. But that's not all. She knows what will come to pass, especially in the way of marriages. She foretold, for instance, that Princess Shahovskaya would marry Brentham. No one would believe it, but it came to pass.
And she's on your side.
How do you mean?
It's not only that she likes you. She says that Kitty is certain to be your wife.
At these words, Levin's face suddenly lighted up with a smile. A smile not far from touching tears.
She says that, cried out Levin. I always said she was charming, your wife.
There, that's enough said about it, he said, getting up from his seat.
Well, but do sit down.
But Levin could not sit down. He walked with his firm tread twice up and down the little cage of a room, blinked his eyelids that his tears might not fall, and only then sat down to the table.
You must understand, said he, it's not love. I've been in love, but it's not that. It's not my feeling, but a sort of force outside me that has taken possession of me. I went away, you see, because I made up my mind that it could never be. You understand, like a happiness which is not of this earth. But I have struggled with myself, and I see there's no living without it, and it must be settled.
What did you go away for?
Oh, stop a minute. Ah, the thoughts that come crowding on one. The questions one must ask oneself. Listen. You can't imagine what you've done for me by what you said. I'm so happy that I've become positively hateful. I've forgotten everything. I heard today that my brother Nikolai, you know he's here, I'd forgotten even him. It seems to me that he's happy too. It's a sort of madness. But one thing's awful. Here, you've been married, you know the feeling. It's awful that we, fully mature, with a past not of love, but of sins, I brought all at once so near to a creature pure and innocent. It's loathsome, and that's why one can't help feeling oneself unworthy.
Oh, well, you haven't many sins on your conscience.
Ah, still, said Levin, when with loathing I go o'er my life, I shudder and I curse and bitterly regret.
Yes.
What would you have?
That's the way of the world, said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
There's one comfort, like that of the prayer which I always liked. Forgive me not according to my deeds, but according to thy loving kindness. That's the only way she can forgive me.
Chapter 11. Levin emptied his glass, and they were silent for a while.
There's one other thing I ought to tell you. Do you know Vronsky?
Stepan Arkadyevitch asked Levin.
No, I don't. Why do you ask?
Give us another bottle, Stepan Arkadyevitch directed the Tatar, who was filling up their glasses and fidgeting around them just when he was least wanted. Why, you ought to know Vronsky because he's one of your rivals.
Who's Vronsky? Said Levin, and his face was suddenly transformed from the look of childlike ecstasy which Oblonsky had just been admiring to an angry and unpleasant expression.
Vronsky is one of the sons of Count Kirill Ivanovich Vronsky, and one of the finest specimens of the gilded youth of Petersburg. I made his acquaintance in Tver when I was there on official business, and he came there for the levy of recruits. Fearfully rich, handsome, great connections, an aide-de-camp, and with all that a very fine, good-natured fellow. But he's more than simply a good-natured fellow, as I found out here. He's a cultured man, too, and very intelligent. He's a man who'll make his mark.
Levin scowled and kept silent.
Well, he turned up here soon after you'd gone, and as I can see, he's over head and ears in love with Kitty, and you know that her mother...
Excuse me, but I know nothing, said Levin, frowning gloomily, and immediately he recalled his brother Nikolai, and how vile he was to have been able to forget him.
You wait a bit, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling and touching his hand. I've told you what I know, and I repeat that in this delicate and tender matter, as far as one can conjecture, I believe the chances are in your favor.
Levin dropped back in his chair. His face was pale.
But I would advise you to settle the thing as soon as possible, pursued Oblonsky, filling up his glass.
No thanks, I can't drink any more, said Levin, pushing away his glass. I shall get drunk.
Come, tell me, how are you getting on? He went on, obviously anxious to change the conversation.
One word more. In any case, I advise you to settle the question soon.
Tonight, I don't advise you to speak, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. Go round tomorrow morning, make a proposal in classic form, and God bless you.
Oh, do you still think of coming to me for some shooting?
Come next spring, do, said Levin. Now his whole soul was full of remorse that he had begun this conversation with Stepan Arkadyevitch. His peculiar feeling was profaned by talk of the rivalry of some Petersburg officer, of the suppositions and the counsels of Stepan Arkadyevitch. Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled. He knew what was passing in Levin's soul.
I'll come someday, he said.
Yes, my dear, women. They're the pivot everything turns upon. Things are in a bad way with me, very bad, and it's all through women. Tell me frankly now, he pursued, picking up a cigar and keeping one hand on his glass. Give me your advice.
Why? What is it?
I'll tell you. Suppose you're married, you love your wife, but are fascinated by another woman.
Excuse me, but I'm absolutely unable to comprehend how, just as I can't comprehend how I could now, after my dinner, go straight to a baker's shop and steal a loaf.
Stepan Arkadyevitch's eyes sparkled more than usual.
Why not? A loaf will sometimes smell so good that one can't resist it.
Himmlisch ist, wenn ich beswungen. Mein irdisch Begier. Aber doch wenn's nicht gelungen. Hat ich auch recht hub's placer. As he said this, Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled subtly.
Levin, too, could not help smiling.
Yes, but joking apart, resumed Oblonsky, you must understand that the woman, a sweet, gentle, loving creature, poor and lonely, has sacrificed everything. Now, when the thing's done, don't you see, can one possibly cast her off? Even supposing one parts from her so as not to break up one's family life, still, can one help feeling for her, setting her on her feet, lightening her lot?
Well, you must excuse me there. You know, to me, all women are divided into two classes.
Well, no, it would be truer to say there are women and there are... I've never seen charming fallen beings, and I never shall see them, but such creatures as that painted Frenchwoman at the counter with the ringlets are vermin to my mind, and all fallen women are like her.
But the Magdalene?
Ah, drop that. Christ would never have said those words if he had known how they would be abused. Of all the gospel, those words are the only ones remembered. However, I'm not saying so much, what I think is what I feel. I have a loathing for fallen women. You're afraid of spiders, and I of these vermin. Most likely you've not made a study of spiders and don't know their character, and so it is with me. It's very well for you to talk like that. It's very much like that gentleman in Dickens who used to fling all difficult questions over his right shoulder with his left hand. But denying the facts is no answer. What's to be done? You tell me that. What's to be done? Your wife gets older while you are full of life. Before you've time to look round, you feel that you can't love your wife with love, however much you may esteem her. And then all at once, love turns up and you're done for. You're done for, Stepan Arkadyevich said with weary despair. Levin smiled slightly. Yes, you're done for, resumed Oblonsky. But what's to be done? Don't steal loaves. Stepan Arkadyevich laughed outright. Oh, moralist, but you must understand there are two women. One insists only on her rights, and those rights are your love, which you can't give her, while the other sacrifices everything for you and asks for nothing. What are you to do? How are you to act? There's a fearful tragedy in it. If you care for my profession of faith as regards that, I'll tell you that I don't believe there was any tragedy about it. And this is why. To my mind, love, both sorts of love, which you remember Plato defines in his Banquet, serve as the touchstone of men. Some men only understand one sort, and some only the other. And those who only know the non-Platonic love talk in vain of tragedy. In such love there can be no short of tragedy. I'm much obliged for the gratification, my humble respects, and that's all the tragedy. And in Platonic love there can be no tragedy, because in that love all is clear and pure, because in that instant Levin recollected his own sins and the inner conflict he had lived through, and he added unexpectedly, but perhaps you are right. Very likely. I don't know. I positively don't know. You see, said Stepan Arkadyevich, you're very much all of a piece. That's your quality and your failing. You have a character that's all of a piece, and you want the whole of life to be of a piece too, but that's not how it is. You despise public official work because you want the reality to be constantly corresponding with the aim, and that's not how it is. You want a man's work too, always to have a defined aim, and love and family life always to be undivided, and that's not how it is. All the variety, all the charm, all the beauty of life is made up of light and shadow. Levin sighed and made no reply. He was thinking of his own affairs and was not listening to Oblonsky. And suddenly both of them felt that though they were friends, though they had been dining together and drunk wine which should have drawn them closer, yet each was thinking only of his own affairs, and they had nothing to do with one another. Oblonsky had more than once experienced this extreme sense of aloofness instead of intimacy coming on after dinner, and he knew what to do in such cases. Let's have the check, he called, and he went into the next room where he promptly came across an aide-de-camp of his acquaintance and dropped into conversation with him about an actress and her projector. And at once in this conversation with the aide-de-camp, Oblonsky had a sense of relaxation and relief after his conversation with Levin, which always put him to too great a mental and spiritual strain. When the Tatar appeared with a check of 26 rubles and some kopecks, besides a tip for himself, Levin, who would another time have been horrified, like anyone from the country, at his share of 14 rubles, did not notice it, paid, and set off homeward to dress and go to the Shcherbatskys', where his fate was to be decided. Chapter 12. The young princess, Kitty Shcherbatskaya, was 18. It was the first winter that she had been out in the world. Her success in society had been greater than that of either of her elder sisters, and greater even than her mother had anticipated, to say nothing of the young men who danced at the Moscow balls being almost all in love with Kitty. Two serious suitors had already the first winter made their appearance, Levin, and immediately after his departure, Count Vronsky. Levin's appearance at the beginning of the winter, his frequent visits, and evident love for Kitty, had led to the first serious conversations between Kitty's parents as to her future, and to disputes between them. The prince was on Levin's side. He said he wished for nothing better for Kitty. The princess, for her part, going round the question in the manner peculiar to women, maintained that Kitty was too young, that Levin had done nothing to prove that he had serious intentions, that Kitty felt no great attraction to him, and there were some other reasons too, but she did not state the principal point, which was that she looked for a better match for her daughter, that Levin was not to her liking, and that she did not understand him. When Levin had abruptly departed, the princess was delighted and said to her husband triumphantly, "You see, I was right." When Vronsky appeared on the scene, she was still more delighted, confirmed in her opinion that Kitty was to make not simply a good, but a brilliant match. In the mother's eyes, there could be no comparison between Vronsky and Levin. The mother disliked in Levin his strange and uncompromising opinions and his shyness in society, founded on his pride, as she supposed, and his queer sort of life, as she considered it, absorbed in cattle and peasants. She did not very much like that he, who was in love with her daughter, had kept coming to the house for 6 weeks, as though he was waiting for something, inspecting, as though he were afraid he might be doing them too great an honor by making a proposal, and did not realize that a man who continually visits at a house where there is a young unmarried girl is bound to make his intentions clear. And suddenly, without doing so, he disappeared. "It's as well he's not attractive enough for Kitty to have fallen in love with him," thought the mother. Vronsky satisfied all the mother's desires. Very wealthy, clever, of aristocratic family, on the high road to a brilliant career in the army and at court, and a fascinating man. Nothing better could be wished for. Vronsky openly flirted with Kitty at balls, danced with her, and came continually to the house. Consequently, there could be no doubt of the seriousness of his intentions. But in spite of that, the mother had spent the whole of that winter in a state of terrible anxiety and agitation. Princess Shcherbatskaya had herself been married 30 years ago, her aunt arranging the match. The wooer, about whom everything was well known beforehand, had come, looked at his intended, and been looked at. The matchmaking aunt had ascertained and communicated their mutual impression. That impression had been favorable. Afterward, on a day fixed beforehand, the expected proposal was made to her parents and accepted. All had passed very simply and easily. So it seemed, at least to the princess. But over her own daughters she had felt how far from simple and easy is the business, apparently so commonplace, of marrying off one's daughters. The panics that had been lived through, the thoughts that had been brooded over, the money that had been wasted, and the disputes with her husband over marrying the two elder girls, Daria and Natalia. Now, since the youngest began to come out in the world, the princess was going through the same terrors, the same doubts, and still more violent quarrels with her husband than she had over the elder girls. The old prince, like all fathers indeed, were exceedingly scrupulous on the score of the honor and reputation of his daughters. He was unreasonably jealous over his daughters, especially over Kitty, who was his favorite, and at every turn he had scenes with the princess for compromising her daughter. The princess had grown accustomed to this already with her other daughters, but now she felt that there was more ground for the prince's scrupulousness. She saw that of late years much was changed in the manners of society, that a mother's duties had become still more difficult. Girls of Kitty's age formed some sort of clubs, went to some sort of lectures, mixed freely in men's society, drove about the streets alone. Many of them did not curtsy, and what was the most important thing, all of them were firmly convinced that to choose their husband was their own affair, and not their parents'. "Marriages aren't made nowadays as they used to be," was thought and said by all these young girls, and even by their elders. But just how marriages were made nowadays, the princess could not learn from anyone. The French fashion of the parents arranging their children's future was not accepted. It was condemned. The English fashion of the complete independence of girls was also not accepted, and not possible in Russian society. The Russian fashion of matchmaking was considered unseemly. It was ridiculed by everyone, even by the princess herself. But how girls were to be married, and how parents were to marry them, no one knew. Everyone with whom the princess had chanced to discuss the matter said the same thing. "Mercy on us, it's high time in our day to cast off all that old-fashioned business. It's the young people have to marry and not their parents, and so we ought to leave the young people to arrange it as they choose. It was very easy for anyone to say who had no daughters, but the princess realized that, in the process of getting to know each other, her daughter might fall in love and fall in love with someone who did not care to marry her or who was quite unfit to be her husband. And however much it was instilled into the princess that in our times young people ought to arrange their lives for themselves, she was unable to believe it, just as she would have been unable to believe that, at any time whatever, loaded pistols were the most suitable playthings for children 5 years old. And so the princess was more uneasy over Kitty than she had been over the elder daughters. Now she was afraid that Vronsky might confine himself to simply flirting with her daughter. She saw that her daughter was in love with him, but tried to comfort herself with the thought that he was an honorable man and would not do this. But at the same time she knew how easy it is, with the freedom of manners of today, to turn a girl's head, and how lightly men generally regarded such a crime. The week before, Kitty had told her mother of a conversation she had with Vronsky during a mazurka. This conversation had partly reassured the princess, yet her assurance could not be perfect. Vronsky had told Kitty that both he and his brother were so used to obeying their mother that they never made up their minds to any important undertaking without consulting her. And just now I am impatiently awaiting my mother's coming from Petersburg as a peculiar piece of luck, he had told her. Kitty had repeated this without attaching any significance to the words, but her mother saw them in a different light. She knew that the old lady was expected from day to day and that she would be pleased at her son's choice, and she felt it strange that he should not make his proposal through fear of vexing his mother. However, she was so anxious for the marriage itself and still more for relief from her fears that she believed it was so. Bitter as it was for the princess to see the unhappiness of her eldest daughter, Dolly, on the point of leaving her husband, her anxiety over the decision of her youngest daughter's fate engrossed all her feelings. Today, with Levin's reappearance, a fresh source of anxiety arose. She was afraid that her daughter, who had at one time, as she fancied, a feeling for Levin, might, from an extreme sense of honesty, refuse Vronsky, and that Levin's arrival might generally complicate and delay the affair, now so near conclusion. "Why, has he been here long?" the princess asked about Levin as they returned home. "He came today, ma'am." "There's one thing I want to say," began the princess, and from her serious and alert face, Kitty guessed what it would be. "Mama," she said, flushing hotly and turning quickly to her, "please, please don't say anything about that. I know all about it." She wished what her mother wished for, but the motives of her mother's wishes hurt her. "I only want to say that to raise hopes." "Mama, darling, for goodness sake, don't talk about it. It's so horrible to talk about it." "I won't," said her mother, seeing the tears in her daughter's eyes. "But one thing, my love, you promised me you would have no secrets from me. You won't?" "Never, Mama, none," answered Kitty, flushing and looking her mother straight in the face. "But I have nothing to tell you now, and if I wanted to, I don't know what to say or how. I don't know." No, she could not tell an untruth with those eyes, thought the mother, smiling at her agitation and happiness. The princess smiled, so immense and so important seemed to the poor child everything that was taking place just now in her soul. Chapter 13. After dinner, until the beginning of the evening, Kitty was experiencing a sensation akin to that of a young man before a battle. Her heart throbbed violently, and her thoughts would not rest on anything. She felt that this evening, when both these men would meet for the first time, would be a turning point in her life, and she was continually picturing them to herself, at one moment each individually, and then both together. When she mused on the past, she dwelt with pleasure, with tenderness, on the memories of her relations with Levin. The memories of childhood and of Levin's friendship with her dead brother have a special poetic charm to her relations with him. His love for her, of which she felt certain, was flattering and delightful to her, and it was easy for her to think of Levin. In her memories of Vronsky, there always entered a certain element of awkwardness, though he was in the highest degree a fashionable and even-tempered man, as though there were some false note not in Vronsky. He was very simple and charming, but in herself. While with Levin she felt herself perfectly simple and clear. But on the other hand, directly she thought of the future with Vronsky, there arose before her a perspective of brilliant happiness. With Levin, the future seemed misty. When she went upstairs to dress and looked into the looking glass, she noticed with joy that it was one of her good days, and that she was in complete possession of all her forces. She needed this so for what lay before her. She was conscious of external composure and free grace in her movements. At 7:30, she had only just gone down into the drawing room when the footman announced, "Konstantin Dmitrievich Levin." The princess was still in her room, and the prince had not come in. "So it is to be," thought Kitty, and all the blood seemed to rush to her heart. She was horrified at her paleness as she glanced into the looking-glass. At that moment, she knew beyond doubt that he had come early on purpose to find her alone and to propose to her. And only then, for the first time, the whole thing presented itself in a new, different aspect. Only when she realized that the question did not affect her only, with whom she would be happy and whom she loved, but that she would have that moment to wound a man whom she liked, and to wound him cruelly. Wherefore? Because he, dear fellow, loved her, was in love with her. But there was no help for it. It must be so. It would have to be so. "My God, shall I myself really have to say it to him?" she thought. "Can I tell him I don't love him? That will be a lie. What am I to say to him? That I love someone else? No, that's impossible. I'm going away. I'm going away." She had reached the door when she heard his step. "No, it's not honest. What have I to be afraid of? I have done nothing wrong. What is to be, will be. I'll tell the truth. And with him one can't be ill at ease. Here he is," she said to herself, seeing his powerful and timid figure with his shining eyes fixed on her. She looked straight into his face as though imploring him to spare her, and gave him her hand. "It's not time yet. I think I'm too early," he said, glancing round the empty drawing room. When he saw that his expectations were realized, that there was nothing to prevent him from speaking, his face became somber. "Oh, no," said Kitty, and sat down at a table. "But this was just what I wanted, to find you alone," he began, without sitting down and not looking at her, so as not to lose courage. "Mama will be down directly. She was very much tired yesterday. Yesterday," she talked on, not knowing what her lips were uttering, and not taking her supplicating and caressing eyes off of him. He glanced at her. She blushed and ceased speaking. "I told you I did not know whether I should be here long, that it depended on you." She dropped her head lower and lower, not knowing herself what answer she should make to what was coming. "That it depended on you," he repeated. I meant to say, "I came for this, to have you to be my wife," he blurted out, not knowing what he was saying, but feeling that the most terrible thing was said. He stopped short and looked at her. She was breathing heavily without looking at him. She was feeling ecstasy. Her soul was flooded with happiness. She had never anticipated that his utterance of love would produce such a powerful effect on her, but it lasted only an instant. She remembered Vronsky. She lifted her clear, truthful eyes, and seeing Levin's desperate face, she answered hastily, "That cannot be. Forgive me." A moment ago, and how close she had been to him, of what importance in his life, and how aloof and remote from him she had become now. "It could not have been otherwise," he said, without looking at her. He bowed and was about to leave. Chapter 14. But at that very moment the princess came in. There was a look of horror on her face when she beheld them alone and saw their disturbed faces. Levin bowed to her and said nothing. Kitty neither spoke nor lifted her eyes. "Thank God she has refused him," thought the mother, and her face lighted up with the habitual smile with which she greeted her guests on Thursdays. She sat down and began questioning Levin about his life in the country. He sat down again, waiting for other visitors to arrive in order to go off unnoticed. 5 minutes later, there came in a friend of Kitty's, married the preceding winter, Countess Nordstone. She was a thin, sallow, sickly-looking, and nervous woman with brilliant black eyes. She was fond of Kitty, and her affection for her showed itself, as the affection of married women for girls always does, in the desire to make a match for Kitty after her own ideal of married happiness. She wanted her to marry Vronsky. Levin, she had often met at the Shabotsky's early in the winter, and she had always disliked him. Her invariable and favorite pursuit when they met consisted of making fun of him. "I do like it when he looks down at me from the height of his grandeur, or breaks off his wise conversation with me because I'm a fool or is condescending to me. I like that so, to see him condescending. I am so glad he can't bear me," she used to say of him. She was right, for Levin actually could not bear her and despised her for what she was proud of and regarded as a fine characteristic, her nervousness, her refined contempt, and indifference for everything coarse and earthly. The Countess Nordstone and Levin had got into that mutual relation not infrequently seen in society when two persons who remain externally on friendly terms despise each other to such a degree that they cannot even take each other seriously and cannot even be offended by each other. The Countess Nordstone pounced upon Levin at once. "Ah, Konstantin Dmitrievich, so you've come back to our corrupt Babylon," she said, giving him her tiny yellow hand and recalling what he had chanced to say early in the winter, that Moscow was a Babylon. "Come, is Babylon reformed, or have you degenerated?" she added, glancing with a simper at Kitty. "It's very flattering for me, Countess, that you remember my words so well," responded Levin, who had succeeded in recovering his composure, and at once from habit dropped into his tone of joking hostility to the Countess Nordstone. "They must certainly make a great impression on you." "Oh, I should think so. I always note everything down. Well, Kitty, have you been skating again?" And she began talking to Kitty. Awkward as it was for Levin to withdraw now, it would still have been easier for him to perpetrate this awkwardness than to remain all the evening and see Kitty, who glanced at him now and then and avoided his eyes. He was on the point of getting up when the princess, noticing that he was silent, addressed him. "Shall you be long in Moscow? You're busy with the Zemstvo, though, aren't you, and can't be away for long?" "No, princess, I'm no longer a member of the board," he said. "I have come up for a few days." "There's something the matter with him," thought Countess Nordstone, glancing at his stern, serious face. "He isn't in his old argumentative mood, but I'll draw him out. I do love making a fool of him before Kitty, and I'll do it." "Konstantin Dmitrievich," she said to him, "do explain to me, please, what does it mean? You know all about such things. In our village of Kaluga, all the peasants and all the women have drunk up all they possess, and now they can't pay us any rent. What's the meaning of that? You always praise the muzhiks so." At that instant, another lady came into the room, and Levin got up. "Excuse me, Countess, but I really know nothing about it and can't tell you anything," he said, and looked round at the officer who came in behind the lady. "That must be Vronsky," thought Levin, and to be sure of it, glanced at Kitty. She had already had time to look at Vronsky and look round at Levin, and simply from the look in her eyes that grew unconsciously brighter, Levin knew that she loved this man, knew it as surely as if she had told him in so many words. But what sort of a man was he? Now, whether for good or for ill, Levin could not choose but remain. He must find out what the man was like whom she loved. There are people who, on meeting a successful rival, no matter in what, are at once disposed to turn their backs on everything good in him and to see only what is bad. There are people who, on the contrary, desire above all to find in that successful rival the qualities by which he has worsted them and seek with a throbbing ache at heart only what is good. Levin belonged to the second class, but he had no difficulty in finding what was good and attractive in Vronsky. It was apparent at the first glance. Vronsky was a squarely built, dark man, not very tall, with a good-humored, handsome, and exceedingly calm and firm face. Everything about his face and figure, from his short, cropped black hair and freshly shaven chin, down to his loosely fitting, brand-new uniform, was simple and at the same time elegant. Making way for the lady who had come in, Vronsky went up to the princess and then to Kitty. As he approached her, his beautiful eyes shone with an especially tender light and with a faint, happy, and modestly triumphant smile, so it seemed to Levin. Bowing carefully and respectfully over her, he held out his small, broad hand to her. Greeting and saying a few words to everyone, he sat down without once glancing at Levin, who had never taken his eyes off him. "Let me introduce you," said the princess, indicating Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrievich Levin, Count Alexei Kirillovich Vronsky." Vronsky got up and, cordially looking at Levin, shook hands with him. "I believe I was to have dined with you this winter," he said, smiling his simple and open smile, "but you had unexpectedly left for the country." "Konstantin Dmitrievich despises us and hates the town and us townspeople," said Countess Nordstone. "My words must make a deep impression on you, since you remember them so well," said Levin, and suddenly becoming conscious that he had said just the same thing before, he reddened. Vronsky looked at Levin and Countess Nordstone and smiled. "Are you always in the country?" he inquired. "I should think it must be dull in the winter." "It's not dull if one has work to do. Besides, one's not dull by oneself," Levin replied abruptly. "I am fond of the country," said Vronsky, noticing, yet affecting not to notice, Levin's tone. "But I hope, Count, you would not consent to live in the country always," said Countess Nordstone. "I don't know. I have never tried for long. I experienced a queer feeling once," he went on. "I never longed so for the country, Russian country, with vast shoes and peasants, as when I was spending a winter with my mother in Nice. Nice itself is dull enough, you know, and indeed Naples and Sorrento are only pleasant for a short time, and it's just there that Russia comes back to one's mind most vividly, and especially the country. It's as though," he talked on, addressing both Kitty and Levin, turning his serene, friendly eyes from one to the other, and saying obviously just what came into his head. Noticing that Countess Nordstone wanted to say something, he stopped short without finishing what he had begun and listened attentively to her. The conversation did not flag for an instant, so that the old princess, who always kept in reserve in case a subject should be lacking, two heavy guns, the classical and professional education and universal military service, had not to move out either of them, while Countess Nordstone had no chance of chafing Levin. Levin wanted to and could not take part in the general conversation, saying to himself in every instant, "Now go." He still did not go, as though waiting for something. The conversation fell upon table turning and spirits, and Countess Nordstone, who believed in spiritualism, began to describe the miracle she had seen. "Ah, Countess, you really must take me, for pity's sake. Do take me to see them. I have never seen anything extraordinary, though I am always on the lookout for it everywhere," said Vronsky, smiling. "Very well, next Saturday," answered Countess Nordstone. "But you, Konstantin Dmitrievich, are you a believer?" she asked Levin. "Why do you ask me? You know what I shall say. But I want to hear your opinion." "My opinion," answered Levin, "is merely that this table turning proves that educated society, so-called, is no higher than the peasants. They believe in the evil eye and in witchcraft and conjurations, while we..." "Oh, then you aren't a believer." "I can't believe, Countess." "But if I've seen for myself..." "The peasant women, too, tell us they have seen hobgoblins." "Then you think I tell a lie?" And she laughed a mirthless laugh. "Oh, no, Masha. Konstantin Dmitrievich merely said he could not believe," said Kitty, blushing for Levin, and Levin saw this, and still more exasperated, would have answered. But Vronsky, with his bright, frank smile, rushed to the support of the conversation, which was threatening to become disagreeable. "You do not admit the possibility at all?" he queried. "But why not? We admit the existence of electricity, of which we know nothing. Why should there not be some new force, still unknown to us, which..." "When electricity was discovered," Levin interrupted hurriedly, "it was only the phenomenon that was discovered, and it was unknown from what it proceeded, and what were its effects, and ages passed before its applications were conceived. But the spiritualists, on the contrary, have begun with tables writing for them, and spirits appearing to them, and have only later started saying it is an unknown force." Vronsky listened attentively to Levin, as he always did listen, obviously interested in his words. "Yes, but the spiritualists say we don't know at present what this force is, but there is a force, and these are the conditions in which it acts. Let the scientific men find out what the force consists of. No, I don't see why there should not be a new force. Why? Because with electricity, Levin interrupted again. Every time you rub tar against wool, a certain phenomenon is manifested. But in this case, it does not happen every time. And so it follows, it is not a natural phenomenon. Feeling probably that the conversation was taking a tone too serious for a drawing room, Vronsky made no rejoinder. But by way of trying to change the conversation, he smiled brightly and turned to the ladies. Do let us try it once, Countess, he said, but Levin would finish saying what he thought. I think, he went on, that this attempt of the spiritualists to explain their miracles as some sort of new natural force is most futile. They boldly talk of spiritual force and then try to subject it to material experiment. Everyone was waiting for him to finish, and he felt this. Why, I think you would be a first-rate medium, said Countess Nordstone. There's something enthusiastic about you. Levin opened his mouth, was about to say something, reddened, and said nothing. Do let us try table turning at once, please, said Vronsky. Princess, will you allow it? And Vronsky stood up, looking about for a little table. Kitty got up to fetch a table, and as she passed, her eyes met Levin's. She felt for him with her whole heart, the more because she was pitying him for a suffering of which she was herself the cause. If you can forgive me, said her eyes. I am so happy. I hate them all, and you, and myself, his eyes responded, and he took up his hat. But he was not destined to escape. Just as they were arranging themselves round the table, and Levin was on the point of retiring, the old prince came in, and after greeting the ladies, addressed Levin. Ah, he began joyously, been here long, my boy? I didn't even know you were in town. Very glad to see you. The old prince embraced Levin and, talking to him, did not observe Vronsky, who had risen and was calmly waiting till the prince should turn to him. Kitty felt how grievous her father's cordiality was to Levin after what had happened. She saw, too, how coldly her father responded at last to Vronsky's bow, and how Vronsky looked with amiable perplexity at her father, trying and failing to understand how and why anyone could be hostily disposed toward him, and she flushed. Prince, let us have Konstantin Dmitrievich, said Countess Nordstone. We want to try an experiment. What experiment? Table turning? Well, you must excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, but to my mind it is far better fun to play the ring game, said the old prince, looking at Vronsky, and guessing that it had been his suggestion. There's some sense in that, anyway. Vronsky looked wonderingly at the prince with his firm eyes and with a faint smile, began immediately talking to Countess Nordstone of the great ball that was to come off next week. I hope you will be there, he said to Kitty. As soon as the old prince turned away from him, Levin slipped out unnoticed, and the last impression he carried away with him of that evening was the smiling, happy face of Kitty, answering Vronsky's inquiry about the ball. Chapter 15. At the end of the evening, Kitty told her mother of her conversation with Levin, and in spite of all the pity she felt for Levin, she was glad at the thought that she had received a proposal. She had no doubt that she had acted rightly, but after she had gone to bed, she could not sleep for a long while. One impression pursued her relentlessly. It was Levin's face with his scowling brows and his kind eyes looking out in dark dejection below them, as he stood listening to her father and glancing at her and at Vronsky. And she felt so sorry for him that tears came into her eyes. But immediately she thought of the man for whom she had given him up. She vividly recalled his manly, firm face, his noble calmness, and the good nature so conspicuous toward everyone. She remembered the love for her of the man she loved, and once more all was gladness in her soul, and she lay on the pillow smiling with happiness. I'm sorry, but what could I do? It's not my fault, she said to herself, but an inner voice told her otherwise. Whether she felt remorse at having captivated Levin or at having refused him, she did not know, but her happiness was poisoned by doubts. Lord, have pity on us. Lord, have pity. Lord, have pity, she said over to herself until she fell asleep. Meanwhile, there took place below in the prince's little study one of the scenes so often repeated between the parents on account of their favorite daughter. What? "I'll tell you what," shouted the prince, brandishing his arms and at once wrapping his squirrel-lined dressing gown round him again, "that you've no pride, no dignity, that you're disgracing, ruining your daughter by this vulgar, stupid matchmaking." "But really, for mercy's sake, prince, what have I done?" said the princess, almost crying. She, pleased and happy after her conversation with her daughter, had gone to the prince to say good night as usual. And though she had no intention of telling him of Levin's proposal and Kitty's refusal, still she hinted to her husband that she fancied things were practically settled with Vronsky, and would be definitely so as soon as his mother arrived. And thereupon, at those words, the prince had all at once flown into a passion and begun to use unseemly language. "What have you done? I'll tell you what. First of all, you're trying to allure an eligible gentleman, and all Moscow will be talking of it, and with good reason. If you have evening parties, invite everyone. Don't pick out the possible suitors. Invite all these whelps," so the prince styled the youths of Moscow, "engage a piano player and let them dance, and not as you did tonight, only the wooers and doing your matching. It makes me sick, sick to see it, and you've gone on till you've turned the poor lass's head. Levin's a thousand times the better man. As for this Peterburg swell, they're turned out by machinery, all on one pattern and all precious rubbish. But if he were a prince of the blood, my daughter need not run after anyone." "But what have I done?" "Why, you've," the prince was yelling wrathfully. "I know if one were to listen to you," interrupted the princess, "we should never marry off our daughter. If it's to be so, we'd better go into the country." "Well, we had better. But do wait a minute. Do I wheedle them? I don't wheedle them in the least. A young man and a very nice one has fallen in love with her, and she, I fancy." "Oh, yes, you fancy. And how if she really is in love, and he's no more thinking of marriage than I am? Oh, that I should live to see it. Ah, spiritualism. Ah, nice. Ah, the ball." And the prince, imagining he was mimicking his wife, made a mincing curtsy at each word. "And this is how we prepare wretchedness for Katinka? And she's really got the notion into her head? But what makes you suppose so?" "I don't suppose. I know. For such things we have eyes. Women folk haven't. I see a man who has serious intentions. That's Levin. And I see a quail, like this cackler, who's only amusing himself." "Oh, well, when once you get an idea into your head, well, you'll remember my words, but too late. Just as with Dashenka." "Well, well, we won't talk of it," the princess stopped him, recollecting her unlucky dolly. "By all means, and good night." And signing each other with the cross, the husband and wife parted with a kiss, feeling that each remained of his or her own opinion. The princess had at first been quite certain that that evening had settled Kitty's fortune, and that there would be no doubt of Vronsky's intention, but her husband's words had disturbed her. And returning to her own room, in terror before the unknown future, she too, like Kitty, repeated several times in her heart, "Lord, have pity, Lord, have pity, Lord, have pity." Chapter 16. Vronsky had never had a real home life. His mother had been, in her youth, a brilliant society woman, who had had during her married life, and still more afterward, many love affairs notorious in the whole fashionable world. His father he scarcely remembered, and he had been educated in the Corps of Pages. Leaving the school very young as a brilliant officer, he had at once got into the circle of wealthy Peterburg army men. Although he did go more or less into Peterburg society, his love affairs had always hitherto been outside of it. In Moscow, he had for the first time felt, after his luxurious and coarse life at Peterburg, all the charm of intimacy with a sweet and innocent girl of his own rank, who cared for him. It never even entered his head that there could be any harm in his relations with Kitty. At balls, he danced principally with her. He was a constant visitor at her house. He talked to her as people commonly do talk in society, all sorts of nonsense, but nonsense to which he could not help attaching a special meaning in her case. Although he said nothing to her that he could not have said before everybody, he felt that she was becoming more and more dependent upon him. And the more he felt this, the better he liked it, and the tenderer was his feeling for her. He did not know that this mode of behavior in relation to Kitty had a definite character, and that is courting young girls with no intention of marriage, and that such courting is one of the evil actions common among brilliant young men such as he was. It seemed to him that he was the first who had discovered this pleasure, and he was enjoying his discovery. If he could have heard what her parents were saying that evening, if he could have put himself at the point of view of the family and have heard that Kitty would be unhappy if he did not marry her, he would have been greatly astonished and would not have believed it. He could not believe that what gave such great and delicate pleasure to him, and above all to her, could be wrong. Still less could he have believed that he ought to marry. Marriage had never presented itself to him as a possibility. He not only disliked family life, but a family, and especially a husband, in accordance with the views general in the bachelor world in which he lived, were conceived as something alien, repellent, and above all ridiculous. But though Vronsky had not the least suspicion of what the parents were saying, he felt on coming away from the Shabatskys that the secret spiritual bond which existed between him and Kitty had grown so much stronger that evening that some step must be taken. But what step could and should be taken he could not imagine. What is so exquisite, he thought, as he returned from the Shabatskys, carrying away with him, as he always did, a delicious feeling of purity and freshness, arising partly from the fact that he had not been smoking for a whole evening, and with it a new feeling of tenderness and her love for him. What is so exquisite is that not a word has been said by me or by her, yet we understand each other so well in this unseen language of looks and tones, that this evening more clearly than ever she told me she loves me. And how sweetly, simply, and most of all, how trustfully. I feel myself better, purer. I feel that I have a heart and that there is a great deal of good in me. Those sweet, loving eyes. When she said, indeed, I do. Well, what then? Oh, nothing. It's good for me and good for her. And he began wondering where to finish the evening. He passed in review the places he might go to. Club, the game of bisque, champagne with Ignatov. No, I'm not going. Chateau de Fleur. There I shall find Oblonsky, songs and can-can. No, I'm sick of it. That's why I like the Shabatskys, because I'm growing better. I'll go home. He went straight to his room at Doucette's Hotel, ordered supper, and then undressed, and as soon as his head touched the pillow, fell into a sound sleep. Chapter 17. Next day at 11 o'clock in the morning, Vronsky drove to the station of the Peterburg Railway to meet his mother, and the first person he came across on the great flight of steps was Oblonsky, who was expecting his sister by the same train. "Ah, Your Excellency," cried Oblonsky. "Whom are you meeting?" "My mother," Vronsky responded, smiling, as everyone did who met Oblonsky. He shook hands with him, and together they ascended the steps. "She is to be here from Peterburg today. I was looking out for you till 2 o'clock last night. Where did you go from the Shabatskys?" "Home," answered Vronsky. "I must own I felt so well content yesterday after the Shabatskys that I didn't care to go anywhere. I can tell the gallant steeds by some. I don't know what paces. I can't tell youths by their faces," declaimed Stepan Arkadyevitch, just as he had done before to Levin. Vronsky smiled with a look that seemed to say that he did not deny it, but he promptly changed the subject. "And whom are you meeting?" he asked. I've come to meet a pretty woman," said Oblonsky. "So that's it. Honi soy qui mali pense, my sister Anna." "Ah, that's Madame Karenina," said Vronsky. "You know her, no doubt." "I think I do, or perhaps not. I really am not sure." Vronsky answered heedlessly with a vague recollection of something stiff and tedious evoked by the name Karenina. "But Alexandre Alexandrovich, my celebrated brother-in-law, you surely must know. All the world knows him. I know him by reputation and by sight. I know that he's clever, learned, religious somewhat. But you know that's not in my line," said Vronsky in English. "Yes, he's a very remarkable man, rather a conservative, but a very nice man," observed Stepan Arkadyevitch. "A very nice man." "Oh, well, so much the better for him," said Vronsky, smiling. "Oh, you come," he said, addressing a tall old footman of his mother standing at the door. "Come here." Besides the charm Oblonsky had in general for everyone, Vronsky had felt of late especially drawn to him by the fact that in his imagination he he was associated with Kitty. "Well, what do you say? Shall we give a supper on Sunday for the diva?" he said to him with a smile, taking his arm. "Of course, I'm collecting subscriptions." "Or did you make the acquaintance of my friend Levin?" asked Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Yes, but he left rather early." "He's a capital fellow," pursued Oblonsky, "isn't he?" "I don't know why it is," responded Vronsky, "and all Moscow people, present company, of course, excepted," he put in jestingly, "there's something uncompromising. They are all on the defensive, lose their tempers as though they all want to make one feel something." "Yes, that's true. It's so true," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, laughing cheerfully. "Will the train be in soon?" Vronsky asked a railway official. "The train signaled," answered the man. The approach of the train was more and more evident by the preparatory bustle in the station. The rush of porters, the movement of gendarmes in attendance, the crowding people meeting the train. Through the frosty vapor could be seen workmen in short sheepskins and soft felt boots crossing the rails of the curving line. The hiss of the boiler could be heard on the distant rails and the tumble of something heavy. "No," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, who felt a great inclination to tell Vronsky of Levin's intentions in regard to Kitty. "No, you haven't got a true impression of Levin. He's a very nervous man and is sometimes out of humor. It's true. But then he is often very charming. He has such a true, honest nature and a heart of gold. But yesterday there were special reasons," pursued Stepan Arkadyevitch, with a meaning smile, totally oblivious to the genuine sympathy he had felt the day before for his friend, and feeling the same sympathy now, only for Vronsky. "Yes, there were reasons why he could not help being either particularly happy or particularly unhappy." Vronsky stood still and asked directly, "How so? Do you mean he proposed to your belle sœur yesterday?" "Maybe," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "I fancied something of the sort yesterday.